The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
I'm joined by Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach and member of the European Parliament, Paul Hosford, deputy political editor with the Irish Examiner, and Eoin O'Brien, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and party spokesperson for housing. There is much to discuss, particularly the presidential race, which is hotting up. Now, the Sunday Independent has given us a breakdown. Have I got the... No, sorry, I tell a lie. The Business Post has a breakdown of the polling. And it says, exclusive poll, Humphreys in pole position in Oris race. Heather Humphreys on 22%, Jim Gavin on 18% and Catherine Connolly on 17%. Now, one assumes this poll was taken before the Daily Mail, who have splashed across their front page, Humphreys' husband's secret orange order passed. Day of chaos for FG candidate who tries to dodge Mail on Sunday question. And John Lee, his byline saying in this instance, John Lee in Monaghan, writing that he had asked, or that the Mail on Sunday had asked Heather Humphreys if her husband Eric was a member of the Unionist Orange Order. And she said that he was not. And they then followed up with, had he ever been? And she said, you would have to ask him that. And John Lee goes on to write, she also appeared to evade a question about her appearance at Orange Marches, a change in position since this newspaper first reported her regular attendance at the Orange March in Drum, County Monaghan in 2014. Now, here is what she had to say when asked about her attendance at Orange Marches.
When the trouble started, people were concerned and that I didn't go then after that. But I'm glad to think things have moved on a lot. I have been in St. Patrick's Day parades in Coot Hill and here in Cavan Town when orange bands from Northern Ireland took part in those parades. And I think that's a sign of where we are now.
Well, Eoin O'Brien, has Ireland moved on sufficiently that we are happy enough to have a potential president whose husband may or may not have been in the Orange Order and who herself attended orange marches?
Well, first of all, her husband isn't standing for the elections. And I think we need to have a little bit of perspective here. But also, when I saw the story this morning, I was kind of thinking, like, he's an Ulster Protestant. I would have been surprised if he wasn't in one of the loyal orders. Heather is an Ulster Protestant. I would have been surprised if she hadn't attended marches, right? Now, that's not to say, as a nationalist and as a Republican, I'm discounting both the historic and more contemporaneous controversies involving the Irish Order. I mean, I was thinking this morning, for example, the active role the Order played in trying to undermine David Trimble at various stages in the peace process. We still have orange marches taking place in the north of Ireland with UVF bands and UDA bands and going through contentious routes. But at the same time, if we're serious about having a conversation, which we want to have over the next period, about Irish reunification, then we have to accept for Unionists and many Protestants, the Loyal Orders are an important cultural institution. And therefore, while I wouldn't like to see Heather Humphreys as President of Ireland, but for very different reasons, I do think her comments around the need for us to find ways in which we respect each other's cultural traditions. I've been at orange marches, not when I was as high profile as I am now, but when I lived in Belfast, I found them very frightening and very intimidating as a Southerner.
Did you attend in protest?
No. Well, I've attended lots of protests against Loyal Order marches when they were intruding through Republican and Nationalist areas. But no, one day at an early stage in my life in Belfast, I wanted to see what the 12th of July was. And I was living in South Belfast, so I walked right through the centre of Shaftesbury Square. I found it a very, very difficult, intense place. But the idea that this would somehow discount somebody from being a presidential candidate, I think is the wrong approach to this. That's what I would say. And also, I think it's a feature of presidential elections in recent years. They have become far too sensationalised, far too kind of clickbait orientated, rather than having a serious discussion about, for example, I mean, it's interesting in the story, Heather outlines that she now supports and is in favour of United Ireland. It's our belief that there's a very high likelihood of a referendum on Irish unity over the lifetime of the next president. I think we should be having a debate around how all of the potential presidential candidates would respond to that and deal with that within the constitutional limitations and parameters of the president. And in fact, I think the one issue will be not so much Southern voters, but I do think Northern Nationalists and Republicans will be kind of saying, so if she were to be president, and again, I don't want her to be, I won't be supporting her and I'll be campaigning for somebody else. But if she was to be, how would she reach out to nationalists? How will she reach out to Republicans? How will she make a united Ireland part of her presidency?
But oddly, the counterpoint to your argument is that she might be very well placed, given the ecumenical background, to be able to alleviate some of the fears among the loyalist and that broader unionist community.
And that's part of the debate that we'll have. So I suppose all I would say is I would appeal to journalists. Let's have a serious debate. The presidency is important. Let's have a serious debate around values, around the roles and functions of the president. Let's not get sidestepped. I mean, I do think Heather caused herself some difficulty in that if she had just answered the question more forthrightly at the very start, John Lee wouldn't be able to sensationalise it in the way that he has done, right?
But let's face it, she's the perfect embodiment. If we're talking about peace and reconciliation in the future, and we want to understand different traditions, and we want to respect different traditions, she would be fantastic as president because she's embodying the journey that, you know, we need to be on, and so many people have been on. And as a Presbyterian Republican saying, yes, I'd vote for United Ireland, she made that absolutely clear.
And you don't think there's a knee-jerk response south of the border to the words orange order that may have an impact?
Yeah, there is a bit, actually. But there are, you know, I wouldn't defend it for a second, but there's very different types of, you know, the local festival type thing to some of the more extreme marches that we sort of typically associate. But let me just point out, he was a member 50 years ago, Anton, 50 years. I mean, it's a long time. We've all come on a lot of journeys. And I think she's in a fantastic position to understand those different traditions and would be marvellous. A bit in the Mary McAleese line about really understanding the different traditions on our island and bringing them all together.
What about the last point that Owen made about the manner of answering the question begetting an awful lot of unnecessary coverage? Surely a campaigner as seasoned as Heather Humphreys should be better able to ask the question than you'd have to ask him.
I mean, Owen did begin by saying, and I recognise what he said, you know, her husband, well, you know, isn't... Ask her husband. She said, ask my husband. I mean, she's the one running. They wanted to know about the husband. So they did go off and ask the husband, I think. So, yes, but it's clear now what the situation is.
What do you think, Paul? Any impact?
No, it will be a thread throughout this presidential election of answering questions and answering them well. I've been frustrated as an observer watching Catherine Connolly being asked the question about Gemma O'Doherty, because the answer is there. And all she has to do is say, I got it wrong at the time. She's answered the question a number of times, but never said, yeah, look, I got it wrong 7 years ago. The president will get things wrong. I think, like you said, the manner of answering the question is really, really important in this campaign because it's so personalised, because there's no policy to hide behind. Because if you don't answer questions, you will come across as either prickly or ratty. And that's not what people want from their president.
But you don't think the core issue itself, orange march attendance and husband potentially being in the order, you don't think that makes any difference?
No, I think if you look at it, the last time that Heather Humphreys appears to have attended an orange march, according to the copy, is 2014. The Mail asked somebody in Drum in 2014, did she go? And they were told, yes, she goes most years, but it doesn't appear she's attended since. But I thought what was really interesting yesterday, when Heather Humphreys' campaign video launched, there was a thread through it of this constitutional Republican background that we haven't really got from Heather Humphreys before. But it does feel like her campaign team are very wide to the conversation that's already started around the presidency, around that United Ireland issue. Because if Sinn Féin doesn't run a candidate, and we'll know more this week if they will, there will be a vacuum, or there will be a space there where there's nobody whose life in politics has focused on that issue. Catherine Connolly says that she's in favour. Jim Gavin said that he's in favour. But there's nobody who's picked up the baton and run with it for a long time. So could Heather Humphreys kind of come in and say, look, I will give you the conversation about a United Ireland, but I won't bang the table. I won't be shouting. I'll be very kind of calm about the whole thing.
Interesting text along those lines. The fact that Heather is a Presbyterian from Northern Ireland or with Northern links is a plus for me, says one texter. Another, nobody is going to vote to put a former Orangeman in the Auras. Another, she'd be very well placed to work with Protestants in the north of Ireland. 53106 if you view, or 087-1400-106. Meanwhile, TikTok, Owen, when are we getting a Sinn Féin candidate, or is it still an if?
I'm kind of surprised that people keep asking the question when we keep telling you the answer.
20th of September. Well, it's taken a long time. Come on.
No, nominations close the 23rd of September. There's a 5-week campaign and the campaign doesn't really start. I know we're all talking about it, particularly those of us inside the political bubble. But until nominations close, the campaign doesn't formally start. And we have a process. We met in July. We got the party membership consultation report. Membership views are quite mixed. We don't meet in August, so we weren't able to take a decision. And we told people from July...
Do you feel, though, that the train is departing the station without you on it?
No, I think there are two different bits of this. There is those of us inside the political bubble having this conversation, particularly in August and early September, where there's very little political news. The vast majority of ordinary people out there will only really start to connect into this when nominations close and they know the full slate of candidates.
But I think they are curious, Owen, about why you haven't made a
decision. The paper is leading in one way or another with stuff. What's pictures really, in the front of the Sindo, every news agent, people seeing Heather Humphreys really, and no Sinn Féin candidates.
What's really interesting about the opinion poll, which isn't on their front page but it is in the paper, it is Mary Lou, who obviously isn't standing, is also on 22%. But for me, the really interesting thing about the poll is that if you take the combined Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Jim Gavin, Heather Humphreys vote, it's only a single percentage point ahead of the combined Catherine Connolly, Mary Lou vote, right? What that actually shows you is whether there's three or four main candidates, it's going to be very, very tight because the poll also has second preferences. And you can see strong indication of movement between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, strong indication of movement between Sinn Féin and Catherine Connolly. And ultimately, like all presidential elections, it's not who's the front runner, it's transfers. And therefore, I think what this shows is this contest is all to play for. I do think it is going to be a contest around values and a United Ireland and the role of the presidency is going to be one of those. But lots of other key issues. Neutrality is already a key issue. We've seen that from both Catherine and Jim Gavin's remarks. Issues around equality, social justice. And also, we're living at a time where so many of the people of this state are being failed, whether it's children waiting for crucial surgery, can't get special needs places in schools, 6,000 children in emergency accommodation, despite the enormous wealth. And I think while the president can't control those things, the president isn't a legislator, the president helps shape our public debates and reflects where public opinion is at in many cases. And therefore, I think this is going to be a very interesting contest. And we will tell you who our chosen candidate is on the 20th. I'm happy to come here.
And it'll definitely be when, not if.
Well, that's the Ard Cornish meeting.
There's definitely going to be a Sinn Féin candidate.
We can discuss Heather today and we can discuss Jim and Catherine today, but we can't discuss Sinn Féin colleague. But I do want to take up a point about the quality of the campaign. We've had really dreadful personalised campaigns during the presidency. We've had a lot of people who ran really saying they still have not recovered from the quality of those campaigns and the personalised attacks about family members as well as themselves. I think it's really important. We have three very good candidates now, three solid candidates. And I think, you know, the quality of the campaign, how it's dealt with, not sensationalising, but actually looking at the themes, looking at what the role of the president is. What do we expect of a president over the next 14 years? What would embody the Ireland of today? That's the kind of discussion
we
need to have.
Concern about the campaign part of why you decided not to go?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was a factor. But there were other factors as well. But I mean, and also like the stage of political life and the experiences I've had so far.
But the brutality of the campaign is an issue for people putting their hats in the ring.
Oh, I certainly think it is. And, you know, you need courage to go forward and fair play. I mean, I had a number of factors to consider, but certainly the quality of the previous campaigns and the distress and depression that people suffered after it. I mean, we've heard quite a few of the women who went forward totally talking about the distress they still feel. Now, I do think some of it was because people went into the fray who were not used to politics, didn't understand politics and didn't expect that their charity work, if you like, NGO work, would transfer to the presidency. Now, I remember the day I went from being chair of the National Women's Council, the week after in the Sunday papers, as a politician, you're dealt with completely differently. That's one thing Jim will find out as well. And people who are not used to politics, it's a different experience.
Oh, you're nodding about that.
Yeah, 100%. Excuse me. I think there's a misunderstanding from people who jump into things like the presidency about the level of scrutiny that the likes of Owen and Francis are under. Because it's not just when I pick up the phone and ask Owen a question about anything he's done or policy or anything that Francis has been through. The scrutiny is ever present. It's from stakeholders, lobbyists, constituents. And when you jump into something like the presidency, if you're not ready for that, it can be an absolute meat grinder.
And I think there seems to be an assumption among people that they have been in the public eye thus far, and it is a continuum.
The way politicians
it's
are.
It's a very different gaze that lands on you different. When you start running for election.
This is why Jim Gavin's candidacy is going to be really interesting to watch, right? In the sense that, and I say this as a Dublin football season ticket holder of over a decade in length, and somebody who genuinely has a significant amount of respect for Jim, both in terms of his time in the Air Corps, his time in the GAA and Dublin GAA, and also in the Citizens' Assembly. He was in front of our Oireachtas Committee on the directly elected mayor, something he and I feel passionately about, and he was badly let down by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on that front. But one of the hallmarks of Jim Gavin's time in the GAA is he absolutely avoided media engagement. It was probably a very smart move from a football management point of view, much to the distress of journalists. So not only has he never had to express his political or social views, he has no experience whatsoever in terms of dealing with that pressure that when you're in front of the microphone and all of that. And therefore, I think it's quite a big risk for Micheál Martin. I can see from Fianna Fáil's point of view, again, I wouldn't support anybody who's a member of Fianna Fáil in any electoral contest, including this one. And Jim, unfortunately, has joined Fianna Fáil now. So I can see the attractions, but it has huge risk. And we can already see Jim has had two kind of stumbles at the start. He had that very tetchy radio interview recently about the GAA rules, which I know isn't to do with the presidency, but it raises some questions. And then his phrasing around Gaza was just so hurtful to so many people. So I think it's going to be really interesting to watch. I think Gary has it right in the Sunday Times today in terms of that's one that I think people like you, Anton, are going to be really interested to watch while we're busy out trying to get whoever we select.
What's interesting, Anton, is the way, if you like, what was his strength as a military person? My own father was in the army and I understand, you know, where he was coming from. But it's kind of interesting that his strength, like which is having been an army officer, et cetera, suddenly became a sort of an Achilles heel in terms of the language that he used. And I could see from a military point of view, it kind of came naturally to him. But actually, when you analysed it from a political point of view, it was more complicated.
You think he has great political potential, though, according to the Mail on Sunday.
Fine Gael would have loved Jim Gavin to have stood for them. Let me tell you.
No, we did not approach him
especially
for the presidency.
In our Dublin
well,
Broadway.
Our
oh,
yeah, they loved him. We had our own
carefully
candidates.
Phrased sentence there, Francis, because according to the Mail on Sunday, Fianna Fáil presidential candidate Jim Gavin was approached by former Taoiseach Francis Fitzgerald to see if he was interested in running for Fine Gael for her vacated seat. The Irish Mail on Sunday has learned the approach to the Dublin GAA legend was made in November 2023 as Miss Fitzgerald was approaching her retirement from the European Parliament.
Yes, they do report that. And yes, I had decided I wasn't going to go forward again as an MEP. And yes, I did meet Jim and had a chat with him. We were, you know, approaching lots of people. This is before Regina or Josepha had expressed an interest. So I did have a chat with him. But of course, I had, you know, I wouldn't have been able to offer him the opportunity to run, Anton. You do understand that.
Indeed. But you would have thought he would have made a good Fine Gael candidate is what
well,
we're
listen,
understanding.
He was one of
this.
The people that we had a chat with. And of course, I know him well from Clondalkin and Round Towers and the GAA and his family and his dad, who's passed away now, and his mum and the family. Yes, so they were very friendly with
it's
us.
Another wonderful example of how there isn't really any difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at the end of the day.
And you couldn't resist that, you know, you just couldn't resist.
A text saying, Heather Humphreys has already lost the election. I have no issue with her husband being in the Orange Order, but she should have given a straight yes or no answer. Does she not know whether or not he was in the Orange Order? Another, the recent presidential campaigns in Ireland have ironically become unpresidential or very unpresidential. Well, on that note, the Sunday Times is reporting that Conor McGregor, the political, obviously you know who he is, but now political candidate who maintains that he has the support of one large political party, several dozen TDs and the county councils, though polls would argue otherwise. The front of the Sunday Times, McGregor puts society at risk, warns Taoiseach Micheál Martin, saying that Conor McGregor's rhetoric on immigration risks discouraging people from coming to work on Ireland. In a scathing attack on the one-time mixed martial arts fighter, Martin said that McGregor's loose talk and nasty othering of a particular race was fueling division and undermining social cohesion. Meanwhile, over in the States, McGregor says that he is relishing the prospect of getting in front of the county councils.
He should be abiding by democracy. Right now, Ireland does not. And these are my plans and my moves.
I love it, dude. It's good to see. Obviously,
I have addresses with the councils of Ireland this coming week, and I'm very, very excited for it. And I'm even happy how this entire situation has played out and that the councils are to decide that, because I am for empowering local government for the veto over their own communities, as it should be. And from my vantage point, that the councils around Dublin, around Ireland, all around Ireland, and the tireless work that they do, that the entire country of Ireland can see with their own eyes and feel it with response and direct face-to-face communication. It's exactly how it should be. Those councillors should be in the house.
Yeah.
And those in the house should be in the bin.
I think the phrase is what?
Yeah, yeah, I'm at a loss. I've covered politics for a long time. I've covered some bizarre and meandering political pitches, nothing close to that. He has 5 minutes to address Dublin City Council tomorrow night.
But presumably there isn't a prayer of... Is there?
No, no. I mean, to get the council route, like the idea that you can do it without Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, Labour, Social Democrats, Greens, it's just not there. The numbers aren't there. There's a couple of councils you could squeak by if people abstained rather than voted against you. You talk to any councillors, there's no councillor wants to vote for Conor McGregor other than the people who have nominated him to speak at...
Though Elon Musk does. The world's richest man has endorsed him and, according to McGregor, offered him financial support.
The first thing I'll say is I've started to receive emails from a lot of women, some of whom are survivors of sexual abuse and coercive control, for whom actually this is a really concerning proposition. Even though everybody knows he's not going to be on the ballot, the idea that somebody who has the civil case conviction that he has in the Nikita Hannah
civil case finding, yes.
Civil case finding, apologies. That somebody like that would even be considered to be on the ballot is very distressing for a lot of survivors of sexual abuse, and I think that they're right. I also think this trend of people like Elon Musk interfering in the democratic processes of other countries, because it's not the first time, is the opposite of democracy. Countries have rules, rules around funding, rules around campaigning. And Elon Musk has no right to be involved. First of all, he can't fund a presidential campaign. It's against the rules, as far as I understand it, according to SIPO.
But it goes to the power of social media. He's 225 million followers. If that one tweet were an ad, imagine how much it would cost to pay for it.
Sure, but that's not impacting on Conor McGregor's poll ratings. He's down in the very, very low single digits because including whatever one's political views on debates around international protection migration, the overwhelming majority of people in this state take the presidential election seriously. And I think that's reflected in the poll we've seen today. So I think we should be spending less time talking about him. I think it's unfortunate that he's even getting an audience at Dublin City Council, but that's the democratic process. But also keep in mind, right, we've just had an election. People like me who were former councillors were elected, some of us with very, very substantial mandates. And until such time as the voters in the constituency think otherwise, I have an electoral mandate and my place is in the Oireachtas, not in the bin. There are many councillors who have put their, sorry, a small number of councillors who have put their name to Conor McGregor, who stood in general elections and got no electoral mandate in the big house. And I think he should remember that.
It's profile building for
Him. That's what the text is saying. The McGregor answer for the not for the Irish people, they're clearly for an American audience.
Exactly. I mean, it's profile building. When you hear him talking about the role of the president, he said something about, I won't sign any legislation, I'll send it back to the people of Ireland. I mean, that is not the role of the president. There is a process he should follow. So he's no, apart from, you know, the absolute unsuitability in so many ways. And I think that interview with Micheál Martin is interesting, where he talks about the impact on people who are coming to work here because of the racism that's been expressed. That's a very interesting economic point in relation to the consequences of people saying the kind of things that they're saying. So I think it's absolute profile building for himself.
I think it's one of the stranger things about Conor McGregor's candidacy, and it's something that we saw in the last week after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, is this idea that online is every country, that we all share a country because we're all online. This idea that there was talk of, like, from Irish people, far left violence has to be tackled in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination. And you're looking around the streets of Dublin, you're going, where's this far left violence? One of the councillors on Dublin City Council is talking about a minute's silence at the NFL game in in Croke Park on the 28th of September for Charlie Kirk. And you're kind of going, where do we live?
Well, I want to talk more about that after the break, because we're seeing this weekend Tommy Robinson and 100,000 people in the streets of the UK. And again,
billionaires Elon intervening.
Musk, like, big supporter of that.
Like Musk.
Text saying, I disagree that these are really weak candidates and give us a very poor choice. If Sinn Féin put up Michelle O'Neill, I think she'd do really well. I would vote for her, and I would have never voted for them solely due to the fact that other candidates do not reflect any qualities that I would want to see in a president. Well, 6 days? 6 days.
Three days before nominations close. Plenty of time, Anton.
53106 if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. And after the break, we will be looking at that thing of Elon Musk supporting, because we've seen him supporting the far right in Germany. He's now doing it in the UK with that huge demonstration in London. We were speaking before the break about Elon Musk rowing in support of Conor McGregor. Previous to that, Elon Musk had rowed in support of the far right in Germany. He is obviously one of the largest financial supporters of the Trump campaign. And we now see him supporting, both in person through a video and through his platform, Tommy Robinson in the UK. And you were making a point during the break, Owen, that you might return to, about how apparent fringe figures like Tommy Robinson are gaining real world traction in a way that people wouldn't have predicted.
Yeah, and like I follow English politics very closely. I lived in London for a long time with a lot of friends there. And the real story yesterday isn't Elon Musk. The real story is the size of the crowd. It was very, very significant in a city where, if you look at its kind of recent electoral history, it doesn't have much truck with the kind of extreme far right racist politics of Mr. Yaxley Lennon, or whatever his real name is. And I think there's a serious question to be asked, which is, what is it about English society right now? Because this is an English phenomenon. It's not happening in Scotland or Wales, which is creating the conditions whereby so many people feel that's the political space they want to be. And if you look at, you know, both Labour and Tory governments over the last two decades, there are ever greater numbers of people who they are just leaving behind. And you can see that in dramatic declines in electoral turnouts. You can see that in the ebb and flow and the more recent dramatic rise in opinion poll support, for example, for Reform and Nigel Farage, despite the appallingly toxic nature of his politics. And therefore, while I do think the amplification of the kind of hate politics of Tommy Robinson is a concern, and Elon Musk's role is a concern, I also think in that jurisdiction, politicians, and particularly the Labour Party, right, and I think the Labour Party has serious questions to ask. What is it that they are not doing, or what is it that they're doing, which means so many of their former core support base, right? Not just working class people, but lower middle class people, particularly in the Midlands and north of England, feel that their only voice is somewhere between Farage and Robinson.
And Owen, do you see that as a parallel with what happened with what Hillary Clinton referred to as the deplorables in the US, that same cohort that Trump managed to get catalyzed? Is it the same?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the US is an even more extreme example. I mean, their politics is obviously far, far more dominated by big, big campaign finance, by big corporate interests. The gap between regular working people and the political class grows ever wider. And look, it's not like Trump ever got huge landslides, but in those very marginal calls in those states, which were key in terms of the outcome of the presidential election, swathes of people who traditionally would have been Democrats, working class, lower middle class,
or abstainers,
felt utterly abandoned by the political parties that traditionally they had voted for. But the Reagan Democrat phenomenon wasn't the option either, and Trump steps in that. And therefore,
so what's
I do
the lesson
think,
for us? What's the lesson for the UK? What's the lesson for Europe?
Well, I think we're in a slightly different position in the sense that our electoral turnouts are still very healthy. And I don't believe you have that growing gap. But if you look at the last general election, 10% of the electorate voted for either far right and or candidates with a very, very anti-migrant sentiment. Now, they elected virtually nobody to the Dáil, and the few people who had that rhetoric were elected to the Dáil. Majority of them were elected previously. But I do think none of this justifies racism. None of this justifies hate or violence towards minority communities. There are questions to be asked about when people become detached from the mainstream political process, when people feel completely alienated. Are there underlying causes to that? And very often there are, and they're often about social exclusion, they're often about poverty, they're often about economic and cultural insecurity. And I think we have to make sure that those issues are addressed and addressed through.
But at the heart of it, is it that they get a sense that they are part of a community and that they have a voice that they otherwise don't have? Is that what it comes down to?
Well, that's how all politics works. I mean, in real terms, when people get involved in and support political parties and become activists and become mobilised, they feel that that political movement represents them, speaks to them. The big issue is we've seen a trend emerging. The US obviously is one. Germany is another. Portugal and Spain, in terms of some of the far-right parties there, is that political opinions and political movements, which for a long time were on the very, very fringes of politics, political movements whose primary focus is hatred, is division, is not economic empowerment and opportunity, have grown and parts of their discourse have then become normalised and mainstreamed. And you can criticise that all you want in terms of the politics of it, but you have to ask, what are the conditions which led growing numbers of people to support that? And are there policies and politics that those of us who don't like that should be arguing for in terms of economic policies, social policies?
I think there's a number of different levels to this. First of all, both the police in the UK in London and the organisers completely underestimated the numbers who were going to turn up. So that's a lesson in itself. 150,000 people turned up and they were very close to, you know, it was a counter-protest as well. Those were against racism and they nearly met in the middle and it could have been potentially very dangerous. So that's, it's a very interesting point that everybody underestimated, you know, that the strong feeling in relation to the issues it personified. The other point is around Musk. I mean, the idea that billionaires, you know, I saw the video he sent. The video said, fight back or die. I mean, the other point then is about our democracy and where it's going and why immigration was, you know, what people talked about. All of the people I saw interviewed were giving out about so many, a bit of the Brexit kind of, you know, dialogue coming through yesterday as well around the other and the, you know, being demonizing the other was a huge feature of it. So then you have to say, you know, I've said this on this program before, democracy has to meet the needs of people. So in the sense of, you know, taking hold of the migrant, the immigration issue, the boats, they talked a lot about the boats coming through and this symbol of that. Yet if you look at the real figures in terms of percentages and all, this isn't the reality. So there's points about toxic leadership here. And, you know,
but is that filling the vacuum that Owen is describing, that there isn't the connection at local level politically that there should be?
Well, you know, you could say that, but there's a bit more to it. It's the trends we're seeing towards authoritarian leadership, towards toxic leadership, towards demonising racism, you know, coming up, the anti, if you like, gender equality movement in the States. These are all connected. And if people want to use and abuse issues, there seems to be a lot of space now on social media to do that. And that's very worrying.
But there is one important point to make, though, because the kind of toxic politics of Tommy Robinson have always been there. But we have had government after government in England imposing severe austerity on communities. We have people who are experiencing economic stagnation or economic decline. They have a housing crisis. They have a public services crisis. And in that context, the toxic politics of Farage and Robinson, which has already been there, gets a much more fertile ground because those bad
faith
actors...
Though it's partially causative in some of what you're describing.
But those bad faith actors then point, exactly as Francis says, to the migrant who didn't cause the collapse of their economy.
I'm not sure how much the disenfranchised, we'll say, from an economic point of view.
In England at the moment, it is huge.
Oh, no. I know it's huge. And I think there is an issue about Starmer and the fact that Labour have moved away from their base and some of the ways they're dealing with welfare reform and so on is absolutely counterproductive. And I think it's weakening them and very dangerous for them, and it's making room for Mirage, for Farage. I mean, Mirage as well. They're trying to outdo Farage in many ways, and I think it's dangerous territory. And you know, can really.
The lesson for us though is because the Labour Party, both under Blair and Starmer, abandoned their core working class base a long time ago. But this Labour government made a whole set of promises, which they have broken and broken badly. And that then means people feel so disenfranchised. So the lesson for us here is we need to ensure that whether it's in terms of employment, whether it's in terms of housing, whether it's in terms of healthcare, we have governments that actually meet the needs of the people so that there isn't the space, because those bad faith actors will always be there. We have to make sure that they don't have the fertile ground that they've been given by mainstream politicians in the US and in Britain. It hasn't happened yet here, but it has started to happen.
We shouldn't be naive about that either. There is another trend that what you can say in public has become so extreme and almost acceptable, Whereas really up until relatively recent years, you know, you weren't being overtly racist or ageist or, you know, saying dreadful things about people who'd come to live in your country. This now, it's almost like there's a public space now. And of course, the dreadful assassination in the States, you know, leads to a full discussion about that, about what is being said in public that is so, you know, so extreme and somehow seems acceptable.
Yeah, there's two strands for me here. One, you mentioned the local services. One of the things that social media was supposed to do was to bring us closer together. And one of the things that it's actually done has hollowed that out. So I know Francis and I know Owen for a decade and a half because I worked in the local newspaper in Lucan and Clondalkin. That paper doesn't exist as it was. It's now a Dublin-wide thing. It doesn't do... There's nobody going to the council meetings. There's nobody covering local area committee meetings. There's nobody covering the tidy towns or the community groups. So what you have there is a vacuum of a lack of knowledge around what's happening in the local area. Lucan Village, where I covered, where I live, is being done up at the moment. They're changing what, if people have been through it, there's a triangular park. They're changing that into kind of an amphitheatre. One of the local Facebook pages put a thing up a couple of months ago that said, I know the reason that this is delayed because when it was first built, it wasn't facing Mecca. That it had to be dug up and redone because it wasn't facing Mecca. Had the paper still existed, had there been somebody there, it would have been in the paper every couple of weeks. This is why it's delayed. We're talking to the contractor, we're talking to the council. It doesn't happen. There's a vacuum there in terms of local media, in terms of local knowledge. But one of the things that really, really strikes me when you look at the pictures, you look at the video of that protest yesterday, is the gender aspect. Probably 90 to 95% men. And there's two cohorts of men there that you have to watch out for. One is the young man who came of age during the Me Too movement. And one of the things that those men got, and they had no context for how bad things were for women in the preceding years of the Me Too movement. So what they have when they came of age was men are being attacked and they had no female role models. A lot of them didn't have any female friends. So when they went online, they discovered guys like Charlie Kirk, guys like Andrew Tate, who were telling them, you're being told that you are bad because you are a man. And they were not given the context of what preceded them. That generation of men are completely lost. They're completely online. These young guys, early 20s, they're irony dead. They're spending all of their time communicating through memes on Discord servers. They're completely disconnected from the world around them. And they are so malleable to people like Tommy Robinson. You've got the second cohort there is men who were furloughed or laid off or couldn't go to the office during COVID. And COVID impacted the younger cohort as well because they lost out on schooling, they lost out on formative years in colleges, they lost out on social connection to friends. The older men, a lot of them, and you will have noticed it if you were a long-time user of Twitter, if you used Twitter in the mid-2000s, you'll have noticed that during COVID, a lot of the kinds of people who would have traditionally just never engaged with the online world became very, very active, fell down rabbit holes where they were completely unable to communicate, completely unable to understand what was being given to them. The literacy levels for online, I would have grown up in a generation where I was formed on internet forums. So you understand what online conversation was before you ended up on social media. If you don't have that, you're completely lost. And then you have a griftosphere, a world full of people who want to weaponize your anger, weaponize your complete lack of connection to make money.
And social media giants that make money from algorithms that engage you on that basis. We do need to take a break. Coming up after the break, we will be looking at Leo Varadkar's memoir, which has now been reviewed by Gary Murphy, who was on last week giving us a bit of a taster of what that review would consist of. Oliver Callan did a fabulous piece in the Currency, and John Lee has a two-page spread in the Mail.
And Dermot Ferriter in the Irish Times.
Dermot Ferriter. I haven't seen Ferriter's, but you can tell us whether or not it fits with the consensus of the others, which are... less than warm, I think is the way to describe it. Back after this break. We just spent the ad break sharing book recommendations. I have a list now that I have to go and buy. The book recommendations coming from Paul and from Owen. I'm sure Frances had one, but she got squeezed out during the conversation. Owen O'Brien, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest. Paul Hosford, Deputy Political Editor with the Irish Examiner. Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach and member of the European Parliament. And the person responsible for Leo Varadkar, it would appear, getting into politics between him and Jim Gavin, Francis.
Kingmaker.
I used to get into terrible trouble when people would say to me, you know, how ambitious were you in politics? And I said, well, I used to wake up. I never woke up at 15 thinking I'd be Taoiseach. And of course, it was always seen as an attack on Leo, because Leo, in fact, the book review, John Lee talks
about. Actually, I forgot Simon Harris as well.
About his obsession with Taoiseach and being Taoiseach from a very early age. Quite interesting and sort of fascinated by politics, like as an 8-year-old almost, and seeing his mother voting. So it's just a very interesting total sort of dedication to wanting to be there, and not just wanting to be there. But
did you see that when you were dealing with him early on?
Well, he did an internship. It wasn't even I mean, he came for a kind of very short period when he was in transition. Imagine, like, in transition, and he was
that's
going.
At 16.
He was coming. He came into the Dáil, and then he went down to the law court. So it was a toss up, I think, at that time. Although not really, between law and politics. But he just seems to have had this. Now, by the way, his two uncles in India were very involved politicians, and he sort of regrets that he didn't take sort of, like, or wasn't more tuned into his Indian heritage in younger years. So, I mean, it's a very frank account. It's a very personalised account of his journey, you know, from when he was a young guy with mixed race.
Is it a faithful representation of the politician and person that you knew and worked with?
That's an interesting question. I'd say it is. I mean, I think he is, you know, he's always been a fairly kind of straight talker. I mean, I think the power piece probably was on the kind of political motivation is probably even and the action, you know, his activity was all around him being leader, I think. And maybe that doesn't come across, you know, that very, I mean, the ambition comes across, but the kind of how it actually got implemented in the course of the political career, I think, could do with more elaboration, actually.
Interesting then, Owen, in the context of the reviews, because we've Ferreter, we have Lee, we have Callan, and we have Murphy, all of them reviewing the book from various different perspectives, journalism, academia, et al., and all of them arriving at a very similar consensus, which isn't positive.
Yeah, so first of all, I haven't read the book, so I'm not going to comment on it, although I will read it. I'm fascinated by political biographies. Dermot Ferreter made a couple of points. The two kind of standout lines were his description of it as jaunty and superficial. And then another bit stuck out to me for obvious reasons, which is Varadkar apparently makes a point during the course of the book that he feels the only area they didn't do enough on was climate. And of course, I'm kind of saying, what about the housing crisis? I mean, 2011, when he was elected to the Dáil, we had 600 children in emergency accommodation. We now have over 5,000. But I think there's a challenge. Like, there are two types of political biographies. There's ones where the politician tries to give a very honest account of their time and all the challenges. I mean, Gemma Hussey's, I think, really good political memoir is a case in point. And I also think Owen Murphy, somebody who I tracked and I fought, you know, tooth and nail on the floor of the Oireachtas, also wrote a very interesting biography. Some autobiography, some actually for reasons I don't think he even fully understood, it's revealing. But we have far too few of those. I mean, I think of Dan Boyle, Raymond Gilmore's, Rory Quinn's, all kind of just retrospectively fighting the old battles and justifying it. So on the basis of the reviews, this sounds more like in the second, but until I've read the book, I'll reserve judgment.
Paul, have you read it yet?
Yeah, I've read a good chunk of it now. I actually would have preferred it if it was kind of settling old scores. I think one of the things for me is that it's very close. It's only 18 months since Leo Varadkar left office, and he still casts a huge shadow on Irish political life. He was, whether you like it or not, a very consequential Taoiseach, both in terms of his own personal identity, but also, you know, leading the country through the Brexit negotiations, the early stages of COVID, and the latter stages of COVID. So he is a very, very important Irish politician. I mean, we're such an informal country that if you use the term Leo, people will know who you're talking about. I would have preferred a book that was more about the challenge and more about the internal fights and more about the actual nitty-gritty of the politics that he did.
You'd like more retribution, really. That's
I would have liked more.
There is no retribution in it. It's quite kind of soft from that point of view.
But there was one line in it today that I wanted just briefly your view on, which is, he, because it's obviously he has the choice of what he includes. He includes a story of suggesting to Helen McEntee that she would resign rather than take maternity leave.
That's That's strange. Yes, I hadn't. I've only scanned it at this stage. I didn't see that bit. But I mean, I think on the other, his
you
interviews.
You just looked for your name, did you?
I definitely
straight
scanned
to the
that. Absolutely. I will admit that openly. I mean, I was very curious to see what he had to say about 2017, I have to say. But, you know, there's no retaliation in it, really. I think he reserves his ire for Phil Hogan and Tony Hoolan, primarily. No forgiveness
Although,
for Phil.
Kate O'Connell gets a look
Kate
in as well.
In well.
The, fair
but, I mean, I think it's brave. And, I mean, it does give us an inside story of, you know, COVID and government and the dynamics around COVID and the decision-making. And I thought the point that he made, and I've heard it more in interviews than reading the book, was like decisions are not like one or two. They're so complex and multi-layered. And, you know, you eventually get to take the best decision you can.
But Ferdinand makes an interesting comparison with Murphy's book, because Owen Murphy makes a very clear accusation that Leo Varadkar simply did not prioritise tackling the housing crisis. It was one of Owen Murphy's great dissatisfactions. And I suspect that's a question that Varadkar won't address in his book.
Just a bit of a plug for the former resident here, Gavin Riley. He's in the Mansion House as part of the Festival of Writing of and Ideas in conversation with Leo Varadkar. And you can get
and
tickets
at
www.festivalofwritingandideas.com.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.